Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 5th anniversary special production of Out of Bounds. My name is Barbara Mink. I was the former news director of WHCU Radio. I was on the county legislature, and I started the Light and Winter Festival, and I teach at Cornell. But that's not why I'm here. I'm here because I'm a friend of Tish Perlman's. We met in 2001, and she was there when I was deciding not to run again and talking about founding a festival of science and art and painting. And I was there when she had this idea, which of course is impossible, to start a radio show in upstate New York to provide the kind of intelligent and wonderful, interesting discourse that she's provided for the past 5 years. So we've been down this road together, and it gives me great pleasure to open the show. Out of Bounds was created by and has been hosted and produced by Tish since April of 2005. She's a broadcast journalist, writer, and community and political activist. She's a native of Manhattan Beach, California, and a 1986 graduate of the Columbia School of Broadcasting in San Francisco. Perlman worked as a host interviewer on KPFA-FM in Berkeley, Live 105 in San Francisco, and two cable TV shows, OutTalk Magazine and QTV, both in San Francisco. As a freelancer, she's also done voiceovers, public service announcements, and documentary film narration. In Ithaca, she was the interim news director, morning anchor on WHCU's Morning Report, as well as a news anchor on WVBR's Mix in the Morning. She also hosted the Amnesty International Human Rights Journal on Ithaca's Channel 13. Perlman began writing poetry last year, which is quite wonderful. This is a parenthesis, this is mine, for the first time in over 20 years. One of her poems will be appearing in the literary journal The Healing Muse this fall. And she has the distinct delight of interviewing two wonderful women. Rachel Dickinson is an award-winning travel writer from Freeville, New York. Her travels have taken her to places as far-flung as Siberia, Tibet, and the Outer Hebrides, where she's written about birds, monks, and standing stones. I assume in that order. Her articles and photographs have appeared in numerous publications, including Audubon, Smithsonian.com, The Atlantic, and PerceptiveTravel.com. Her latest book, Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Birds, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West, was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in 2009. In it, she follows a hardcore falconer through a hunting season in central Wyoming. She's also the author of several nonfiction books for children, and currently she's working on a book of travel essays. Amy Dickinson is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, The Mighty Queens of Freeville, a story of surprising second chances, a chronicle of her experiences and misadventures as a single mother to her daughter, Emily. She writes the syndicated advice column Ask Amy, which is carried in over 150 newspapers and read by an estimated 22 million people daily. Dickinson is known not only for her wisdom but her wit. Since 2006, she's been a featured panelist on National Public Radio's comedy quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She's also a sought-after speaker, delivering her inspiring and comic stories of her adventures and misadventures to groups around the country. She was born and raised on a dairy farm in tiny Freeville, New York. Population 454. On land her family has lived on since the Revolutionary War. After living in New York, London, Washington, D.C., and Chicago, she moved back to her hometown, married a local contractor she'd known since childhood, and is now mother to five daughters. If you have any questions, write them down on cards. Find me, or I will find you about midway through the show, and we can ask some questions at the end. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Barbara. Now, I want to start this interview by, Barbara mentioned that you were brought up on a dairy farm in Freeville, a location your family's inhabited since 1790. Now, your father wanted you to go into the farming life. None of you wanted to. Tell us what still attracts you to this rural life.
Oh, did I say I was attracted to this rural life?
You've stayed here.
A misunderstanding here. I feel like it just sort of gets in your bones. You know, one of our cousins said one time, she said, we were standing in my living room on Main Street in Freeville looking out at the, you know, spitting snow, and they said, we wish we were from Phoenix, but we're not, you know. So I think it just gets in your bones.
Well, what about you, Rachel?
Well, for me, since I do a lot of traveling, I see a lot of different places. Whenever I start to approach Tompkins County, there's something happens to me, and I think it is at the cellular level. Amy says it's her bones, me, it's my cells. And there is just this pull, this absolute pull, the way tides are pulled by the moon, you know, you just... I can't leave it. Yeah. I tried. I come back.
And our father did try to push us toward farming, you know,
well,
repeatedly.
Well, you've heard that now, right?
Yeah. But repeatedly trying to enter us in the, like, the Dairy Princess contest.
I was going to mention that, and you all refused, and he finally gave up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To my regret, because I feel like, what could be better than to have been a Dairy Princess of Tompkins County? That would be...
But you know, Amy, we would have won. We just know we would have won. There's no reason to put others through that misery, you see. We would have won. I'm confident.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about a serious subject, and you bring this up in your book, The Mighty Queens of Freeville. Your father left when you were both adolescents. Your brother, Charlie, left soon after. Tell us how that has affected your life throughout, that loss.
Well, I think that it, you know, it makes you view relationships with men a particular way. I mean, it took me two marriages to get it right, and I did get it right, and I'm thrilled about that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like you have to go through this learning curve because you didn't have a good example set out in front of you. And I think it's a kind of loss that on some level you never get over, but you just strive to understand it, and I think that's what I've done.
Mm-hmm. What about you?
And, you know, it ends up being this weird kind of headline in your life when you have that kind of abandonment. Because, look, we're sitting here. What are we doing? We're talking about my father, who isn't here. So what I'm trying to do sort of in my life and my work is really focus on the people who are here, mm-hmm. who, like, stuck around. And that's one reason I came back here to live, was to be with these people who really stuck around and stayed and prevailed and, you know, stood up for me and each other and, yeah, the mm-hmm. ones who stayed.
Yeah, those are the ones that make your life rich. I know. I want to talk about your mother, too. You got a remarkable education from your mother, Jane Dickinson. After she was abandoned, she pulled herself up, got a job, and then she went through school and became a teacher. Tell us about Jane Dickinson.
Well, pretty plucky when you put it like that. You know, she was after my dad left, we really lost everything quite suddenly, including cows. And, you know, when you see your cows get taken away for, you know, they were like repossessed. It was really strange. But so she lost a lot, and then she had to go to work, and she got a job as a typist at Cornell, and she just chugged along. And then she ended up being mentored, I think, really thoughtfully by these deans that she worked for, that she typed for. They really encouraged her to attend Cornell, and she did, pretty smart. She went through in 4 years, and then she got her MFA.
And what's neat is she went to school at Cornell when there were no non-traditional students, and she was being pushed toward the School of Human Ecology, and she said, no, I want to be an English major. So she ends up in the School of Arts and Sciences. No one knew what to do with her. She said, can I get out of the gym requirement? And they said, no.
It's like they made her take gym. They made her take Spanish.
And geology. And those were three things she failed. You know. She said, I know I can't do these things. But she just persevered. She found this whole new life. At that point, all of her daughters had left and had gone to college. So we were all having the same experience at the same time, and it was pretty interesting.
And it was cool because my mother and I'm the youngest, and my mother and I graduated the same year. And so she came to my graduation, I went to hers. It was very, very, very wonderful.
And she went on to teach creative writing. Is that how you guys got your love for writing? You both ended up as writers.
I think it's because it was like when I was a cheerleader in high school. My mom.
You didn't want to be a princess, dairy princess, but you were a cheerleader.
Yeah. Well, I had the outfit anyway, because our other sister was a cheerleader. So, but my mother would come to the games. She was so good about stuff like that. She would come to the games, and she would bring a book. And this friend of mine, his mom wanted to meet her, and I said, well, you just look in the audience there, and someone will be reading during the game and looking up during the cheers, and it was my mother. She found her that way, and my mom was reading this particular game. She was reading Anna Karenina. So she was such a reader, and I think that's what it was, and a great writer. So
she was the... She wrote amazing letters, and people just look forward to receiving letters from her. That's how she started writing, just writing everyday life, about her everyday life in these letters. And you know, so we had that example. She was always reading or writing. You know, the housework took a backseat, as well it should, to these other pursuits.
Now, in spite of the fact that you guys are attracted to the rural life and the small town life, you've obviously stayed here, you both have traveled widely. Is that a tug of war for you, to be going out into the big wide world and always knowing you're coming back to this very, very small place?
No, because it really is a relief when you come home. I love to leave, but I also love to come home, because this is more than just geography. Although the geography pulls me, it is all the people who are here who also pull us back. And, you know, there are people who come to Freeville, and it feels like it's a family compound sometimes. Like, where's the gate, you know, that we can open and close? Because we'll walk down the street, and I say, well, that's where Amy lives. That's my Aunt Millie. That's my Aunt Jean. That's my cousin Nancy. And you just walk through the village, and you kind of walk through the pages of our life. And so it's always a joy to kind of return to that, because it's so familiar.
Mm-hmm. Amy, you've actually lived outside of Freeville. You've lived in Chicago, and you've lived in Washington.
Well, and I, unlike Rachel, Rachel's a real traveler. Like, that's real travel. Me, I just keep going to O'Hare. That's not traveling. That's like a commute. And so I actually don't travel at all for pleasure. I haven't in a really long time, because I travel so much for work. But I once figured out that my mother and I really have this in common. We both love to travel, but we hate to be away. So it's like the minute you leave home, you start feeling a little anxious about getting back. And for me, wherever my home is, I feel that way whenever I leave it. I feel like I'm all about returning. So it's just it's a problem. But Rachel's been to these amazing places, really remote and exotic, and I've done none of that.
Mm-hmm. And I actually love the second I get into the car and I'm driving to the airport, I feel free. I feel like I am going to these parts unknown, and I am so excited, I can't wait. And I then get even more excited, because I realize this is my job. This is what I do to make money. So it's a remarkable feeling, and I love that kind of travel. But then I start feeling a little bit bad in the plane coming back, but then as soon as I get in the car to drive back home, I feel that pull, and I can't wait to drive in.
What a nice feeling. Well, what a lucky life, too, to be able to get paid to travel.
It's pretty nice.
Now, you both published nonfiction books last year, The Mighty Queens of Freeville and Falconer on the Edge. Now, both of these books entailed portraits of real people, living people. So where do you draw the line in regard to what you actually reveal? You spend intimate time with these people, especially you with the Falconer story. Tell us how you do that.
Well, my book, I did chronicle the hunting season of this falconer, Steve Chingren, and he's someone that I got to know through my husband, Tim, who's a falconer, and I decided I really wanted to write about falconry because I wanted to understand Tim a little bit better and thought it wasn't a good idea to put his life under the microscope. So I picked up the phone and called this guy, Steve, who I didn't know at all, and just said, look, I'd love to come and watch you fly your birds in Wyoming. What do you say? And he said, sure. So we got to know each other pretty well, and I really liked him, and he really liked me, and I said, I'd love to write a book about you. Is that okay? And his ego kicked in, and he said, yeah, that's great. So I did spend probably a total of 2 or 3 months with him over the course of a couple of years, and it involved me riding along in his pickup truck, holding a tape recorder close to his mouth, trying to get away from the country music on the radio so I could hear what he was saying, and just me asking him questions and him rambling on, and it was wonderful. There were only very few times when he said to me, look, I'm telling you this story, but if you put this in the book, it will kill my mother. So I decided, okay, we'd probably stay away from those. But, you know, there were a lot of intimate stories he told me, and I think as he got to know me, he thought that would be okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like a journalist. You don't say this can be off the record or this can be deep background. Do you give people examples like that they can...
I got nervous when I finished the book, and then the legal department at Houghton Mifflin said, you've got to get him to sign off on this. Mm. And I got him to sign off at the front end saying, sure, she can write whatever she wants. And then they said, he better read this and sign off on it. And I got really nervous because I sent it to him, and I didn't hear for about 2 weeks. And the only part he He had a quibble with one paragraph, and it just had to do with how some other Falconers portrayed him.
Ah.
It didn't have anything to do with his life. It just had to do with some perception. So, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen when you go down that path.
Yeah, you need to use common sense. What about you, Amy? I mean, you wrote about your family. You wrote about your teenage daughter.
Right.
Did you have to?
Well, I sort of use the same rule that Steve Chingren used, which is that I don't want to write anything that will kill my mother. So when it's family members, I feel pretty strongly that, you know, you need consent, and my family was kind enough to basically agree. They knew I was writing this book, but they also knew that the book was really about my life and that there were places where they came into my life and they were in the book. My daughter, Nora Ephron, is someone I know a little bit, and so I sought her advice about this, because, you know, I'm all about advice. And so I asked her, because she's written about her kids, and she fictionalized, you know, heartburn is a very thinly fictionalized account of her life. And so I said to her, how do your sons feel about this book? And she said, well, one of them will always be a little bit mad at me, and the other one is fine. So I asked her advice about how I should approach writing a memoir that included a lot of details, you know, about my daughter's life and certainly about my marriage. Mm-hmm. And she said, it was so smart. She said, it's your story. You get to write your story. What you can't do is write her story. And she said, both of her parents, as you probably know, were famous screenwriters. And she said, my parents were thieves. They used our lives in ways, without consent, in ways that felt really not good. And so she said, go to Emily, talk to her about it, and ask her permission. And that's what I did. And then I worked with Emily on all the sections having to do with her, and she was so helpful because she's really funny. And she remembered stuff that I'd forgotten. And I, you know, she was her presence in the book really enhanced it so much.
Oh, it did. It did. Fascinating what you. But I was wondering if she got upset when you said that Emily inherited dorkitude from you.
Right. Well, listen, hey.
She coined that.
That's her. You know, she and her cousin were talking about, you know, what's the apex of dorkitude, basically. And Emily then reached it. So, and there's
well, what did you mean by that, though? I mean, you guys are clumsy. Tell us more about what dorkitude is.
Really,
seems to run in the family, right?
Yeah. I think it has to do with, okay, there are certain requirements. Love of costumes. Willingness to wear a cape.
Sing Hey Nani Nani at a drop of a hat.
Right. You gotta sing madrigals.
Yeah.
Or contra dancing would also work.
We had a couple dorks in here earlier.
Right. So, I mean, all I can say is you know who you are. And the thing about a true dork, of course, is that they're in love with themselves, you know, as we are. And it's like those very qualities that sort of make you...
unique.
Or sitting by yourself, you know, in the lunchroom, are the very things that you think make you so awesome. And so Emily helped me write this chapter about her, the essence of her dorkitude, and what got me was she included details that I were so embarrassing, I'd forgotten. And that's what I mean. It's like this, to have somebody in your life who's just willing to be out there, go out there with you, together on the limb, and just go for it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the great thing about your family, though. I mean, there was a lot of sadness, and it could have been just stressful and everybody clamming up. It sounds like you guys made it into a party in some way.
Well, I think a lot of people who know us wish we would clam
exactly.
up, probably.
They've had about enough of it at this point.
Well, Rachel, what about you? I mean, she wrote about you in the book. Did you have any kind of veto power?
No, you know, I truly believe that you are allowed to write your own story, and I just assumed that where I would show up in these little cameo roles every now and then would be fine. I didn't even really want to see it. You know, it was her story, her book. I wanted to see the end product. I was really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's portrayed well in this.
In this, and I love the fact that my family members trusted me, but there was this part because my life with Rachel has intersected, obviously, so many places, but especially after my husband left and I ended up living in Rachel's house. And so it was this incredibly important time in my life where she was there for me in a huge way. And so I wrote this chapter, detailing that, and they asked me to trim some of the Rachel bits out, and I was so devastated because I really wanted to sort of portray this, you know, relationship at this time that was so important to me. And I felt like that was one place in the book where it was edited a little bit that it sucked the life a little bit out of this, you know, sort of episode of my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did they tell you? Because it didn't fit with the story of your life, or lost focus?
I think I went a little crazy. I don't know. I think it was like very antic. I remember this section was very antic and a little nutty, and it probably didn't fit with the tone of the rest of the chapter. It was something like that. It was my failing, I'm sure.
Hmm. I want to talk to you about your syndicated Dear Amy column that you started 7 years ago. Tell us the story of how you got that job.
Oh. Well, first, Ann Landers died, and I know, I had nothing to do with that. And I can't say that often enough, really.
I've heard.
So, yeah. So, Ann Landers was, you know, an absolute legend, and she had built up this tremendous, I mean, today we call it a brand. She was this amazing entrepreneur, and she built this tremendous following and this column. And she, it was syndicated by the Chicago Tribune. And I have a friend who works there. You know, everything happens through someone you know. And after her death, I sent him an email because he kept offering me jobs, and I kept saying no. And then after she died, I sent him an email, and I said, okay, there's a job I'd take, ha-ha, you know. And then he stunned me by saying, you know what, we think we're going to try to launch a new advice column, and why don't you try out? And so there were a bunch of us that tried out, and they test marketed the columns because they're so brave in newspapers. They test marketed it. Like, what's up with that? So, but they did. They test marketed the columns for 9 different focus groups. And I was told later that there was one very clear choice. Every single focus group had the same first choice of their favorite advice columnist, and their first choice universally was to bring Ann Landers back from the dead. So I actually came in second.
Well, what do you think it was about your columns, though, that so many people would covet that job? I'm sure so many people tried out for it.
What I remember, Amy, is when you were trying out for that job, they sent you 3 or 5 letters, and he faxed them to you, and he sent you these letters and says, okay, we want you to get your response to this. And you wrote your responses in 15 minutes. You sent them back, and he said, no, you can take a week. And you said, my response would be exactly the same.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that you're a natural at that. And I think that really comes through with your columns. You're funny, and you're natural, and you're also a researcher, so you know who to turn to for advice when you need advice.
Thanks, Ray. And all of that's true. I think that was a huge factor. They gave everybody a week, and I just turned it around really quickly because I knew that would matter. But I also knew this, that given more time, I'd just find a way to screw it up. And I really felt like my first instincts in answering these letters were probably good. And I actually reread that audition column recently, and I think they really were good. They were very representative of what I do now.
Mm-hmm. So you probably think that you would have been overthinking them and polishing them and losing a voice.
Oh, I was going to run down the street. I was going to run them down to my mom's house, no kidding, and get everybody to read and everybody to help. And and I just thought this would really be a mistake because I would have ended up watering it down.
Well, you said in your book that one of the reasons why you thought you were qualified for this job was because, and I quote, as plankton at the end of my family's food chain, I had been on the receiving end of plenty of advice, all of it unsolicited. So you were raring to give out advice, am I right?
Well, it's funny because people always think, people probably have come to you asking your advice, and they asked me that in my job interview. So are people always seeking you out? And I said, I cannot think of one time when anyone has ever asked my advice.
All she's ever wanted was a platform. We wouldn't let her do it, you know? She would try to stand on the dining room table at Thanksgiving and let loose, and we would not let her do it. So she went to the national stage.
It's funny because I'm a real believer in, and I like to think of myself as somebody who still does. In fact, I think I did that today. I generally I tend to ask people, what would you do or what do you think I should do? And whether or not I agree with what they say, I really am one to ask someone else. I actually have this tremendous respect for advice in general. Sometimes it's hard to take it, especially when it's unsolicited, but yeah, I'm somebody to definitely to seek it.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, have you decided that she's better at giving advice than you ever thought when you were younger? And you wouldn't let her talk on the table?
No. She's, she'll always be my little sister. And there will always be this image somewhere in the back of my brain of us being in the milk house together, doing our afternoon chores, washing the milking machines, and me being in fifth grade and she being in third grade, and me teaching her the chorus songs because I wanted to sing the harmony. So she better learn it.
This is how dorks are born, people.
This is how it starts, in the milk house. And when she didn't get it right, I would throw a scrub brush
at her. She would smack me.
Smack her around a little. It's like, hey.
So you brutalized your sister by making her sing? I've never heard of such a thing.
I like to think I made her into what she is today. That's the point of the story.
And you know what? If I flinch now and then.
Yeah.
You know,
actually, you did.
She's got this little tick every now and then.
It's the Rachel ghost coming after you.
But you know, truly, this really is a huge aspect of our relationship is the fact that Rachel preceded me and completely paved the way for me in all sorts of ways. When you go to a school as small as ours was, what your sibling is doing is really, really important, and it impacts your life a tremendous amount. And fortunately for me, I got to be the younger sibling of someone who was like very brave, very, a leader in our school. The teachers really respected her. And so honestly, when I came along, I was given so much latitude. So I feel like I was allowed to sort of be funny and be goofy, and mainly because Rachel had sort of smoothed the path for me to be myself, truly.
Well, I feel like I always sang in the chorus of the high school musicals, and Amy was the lead. This is what happens, you know. It's it's great because there is something about that paving the way and kind of going ahead and then realizing these people are following you. It felt like a real responsibility, actually, as an older sibling.
Yeah, and Rachel and our she was the first person in our family, in our whole family, and that includes our parents, to go to college.
Mm.
So when I watched her go through that process and go and choose a great school and go and excel there, and she let me come and visit her, I then developed a vision for myself as someone who would be brave enough to leave home and do that. So it's incredibly important.
I wanted to ask you this too. I've often read that people trust you because of your honesty and your small town values. Maybe you both can answer this. What are small town values in this interconnected world that we have now? What does that mean to you now?
You know, this is something that was sort of placed on me when I was first hired, and I actually don't really like that term.
I don't either.
Because I hear it all the time.
It's code for something else, and I asked them actually to take that out of all. This is so dumb, but I asked them to take that phrase out of the press material when they were promoting the column because I felt like it implies that other people don't have like good values. And as someone who had lived in cities and lived in lots of places and known lots of people, I don't know, small town values doesn't really have...
I think you're right. It does sound like a code word for people who are better. They have better values than people in big cities.
In the Midwest and Chicago, where I live part of the time, they like to talk about Midwestern values, which I also don't like that. It sounds like you're placing your own cohort above mm-hmm. other things. But I'm sure, you know, they're talking about this attitude of sort of friendliness, being approachable, being, you know, compassionate, being a member of a small community, of a family. That's, I think, what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Rachel, I want to talk to you about the fact that you're a travel and nature writer, and recently you were sent to Northern Ireland by the Atlantic Monthly, and you got stuck there during the volcano from Iceland. Tell us about this great adventure.
I actually, a great gig landed in my lap. The Atlantic came to me and asked if I would blog for 2 weeks for them and just travel around Ireland. They would set me up with these five-star hotels and give me a car, and then I could do whatever I wanted. There was just no restriction. They didn't care what I wrote about. So on the plane over, I'm thinking, what do I do? What do I do? And I realized, oh, Ireland, it's all about the people. Well, and the drinking, but really the people. So I would wake up in the morning, go down to my shabby, you know, five-star breakfast in my five-star hotel, sit there and eat this sumptuous
Rachel, how many
meal.
Stars?
Wait,
the
excuse
five.
Me, maybe five, four or five in there somewhere. And try just to spread out a map in front of me and decide where to go. It was this wonderful opportunity. And once I got kind of used to driving on the other side of the road and the fact that farm machinery was going to take up the other, you know, the entire road that was as wide as my dining room table, and I just had to deal and with the sheep and everything else, I just sought out these stories. And I would write one or two blog posts a day. I'd go home, get a bottle of wine, some bread and cheese, and write my blog posts. And I loved doing this, and my final hotel was in Belfast, which was a fabulous city, and I was looking forward to going home, and then the volcano blew. And at first, I was really excited because I was a geology major in college, and this is a very exciting event when a volcano blows, and it's a really big one, and it's in Iceland, and it's very cool. And then the ash cloud started drifting over Great Britain, and the airport started closing, and I knew I was not going to get out of there. And I thought, oh, what an adventure, and I went, and I was just dealing with that. Yeah, another adventure, something to write about, but I found myself walking down the hallway, and the hotel manager said, hi, how are you? And I burst into tears, and I said, I can't get home.
You know, she was sending SOSs to all of us on Facebook.
Can
you figure out any way for me to get out of Belfast into an airport?
Exactly. I could not get home. Their airports were closed all over Northern Europe, and here was the British government was working really hard to get all the Brits back to Britain, and the stories about kidney transplants and liver transplants and getting people from A to B, and it was like troop movements. They were sending out troop ships, and here I was trying to get to the States, and I contacted the embassy. I said, why can't you send me a troop ship? Get me out of here. And they
get me out of my five-star hotel.
Exactly.
That's how I read this. I was like here in Freeville.
Excuse me. Like, so happy. Yeah. I was.
I felt so the same way. Happy. The five-star hotel. What do you mean asking us on Facebook?
Every day I'd wake up, I'd look at the sky. No planes. Blue sky. I said, give me a sign. At least let my mouth feel gritty with ash. You know, I wanted something, anything. But
it must have been surreal because it just went on and on and on.
You were stuck there for a week longer.
I was stuck there for a week.
Yeah.
And the hotel was great because I had...
How many stars?
Yeah, I had a five-star hotel. And I had a meeting. I had tea with the owner of the hotel. And he has this fabulous art collection. We spent 3 hours talking about art and looking at paintings. And when he heard I was stuck, he immediately got in touch with me and said, you can stay as long as you want. Here are my friends. They're going to the theater tonight. And these people are going to dinner tomorrow night. And he just hooked me up with all of his buddies in Belfast. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. That's my life. Welcome to it.
Well, I want to start taking some questions that came from the audience. And here's the first one. You have a lot in common, but what do you disagree on? Do you fight?
Ooh. Cat fights.
Well, ew.
Let's be honest.
We are Methodists, so yeah, I guess we fight, but it wouldn't be like other people's fighting. It's more subterranean, you know. There's some...
It's with the furrowed brow. Yes.
There's a lot of shooting looks back and forth. But I feel like Rachel and I, but in general our family, gets along extremely well. We really do. And we have to. We're facing some real challenges in our family, like a lot of families are. And life is so much easier if you are with people together.
But don't you wish there were times when we were a big Italian family?
I do.
You're like really let loose and
you guys do is sing, right?
Right. We sing and
but we do get along very well. We get along very well. But one of the things Rachel and I also do is because we both do the same thing for a living, we live in proximity to each other, and I think we're also very good at there's a boundary where we really respect each other's work. We also respect each other's need to do their work, and so I think that's helpful, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Actually, having other writers in the family is really helpful because people don't really understand what it means to be a freelance writer and to work from home. They think you just stay home, or that must be, you must just do gardening and
waiting for inspiration in your robe.
Drive people around, or it's like, no, it doesn't work like that.
Actually working. Here's another question from the audience. Do you have to keep personal and political beliefs separate when you're writing your Dear Amy column? Is that a problem?
Well, wait a minute. What's the question again?
Do you have to keep your personal or political beliefs separate, especially the political ones, I would assume?
Well, I will say this. It's almost like no matter what, how I present my point of view. Oh, I just got this great question, and I called the ACLU. The question is from a girl who said she's on her high school volleyball team, and her coach is making her shave her arms and legs under her arms, and I have this instant reaction to that, which is, of course, when they make the male basketball team do the same, then by all means. But I know that when I run my response to that, I will be accused of being, people who don't like my column accuse me of being a liberal, one of them women's libbers types. And then I get accused. I also love this, people who don't like the column think I'm religious, or they think I'm too conservative. So it's almost like you can't win. But no, I don't feel like I.
You don't censor yourself.
I don't think I do. Mm-mm. I mean, the column isn't political. I mean, it's really about human. It's about relationships. So
yeah, for the most part.
That's why I love that high school letter. By the way, that's going to be very hot.
That'll be big.
This is a question for Rachel. What is your favorite assignment article so far as a freelancer?
Well, the blogging in Ireland was pretty darn nice. I also got sent to Bermuda to write by Audubon to write about the endangered Bermuda petrel. And it was wonderful because I was there with a photographer and a photographer's assistant. The photographer turned out to be a fashion photographer, and I'm thinking, you're going to shoot birds, you know? You understand this, that we're doing birds here? And he's, like, all about high fashion. And so when I saw his photos later, they were gorgeous.
Yeah, amazing
photos. But he was trying to get the birds to pose, and he's, like, you know, clicking
like,
his finger.
Give me your plumage. Work it.
But that was a great assignment because I got to see Bermuda. It's a wonderful place. I hung out with this wonderful researcher, and we puttered around different islands. In
your little golf carts.
No, actually, in his boat. We were on the water, and we would have to leap onto these little rocky islets where these birds were hanging out. And it was exciting and scary and fun. And when I came back, I got on the plane, and the plane didn't take off. Finally, the pilot gets on and says, I'm not leaving because there's someone on this plane who is not going to be allowed into the United States. And we're all looking around like, is it you? And he said, and now Bermuda's refusing to take him back. And so we had this man who was like between countries or had no country at that point. And he said, we are not taking off until they haul this guy off this plane. And so, you know, you get to do stuff like that. I get to have that experience and wonder, will I make it out of Bermuda? Do I have to rent a house here? So there you go.
I want to ask you about the fact that we all live in this beautiful Finger Lakes region. You're a nature writer. You absolutely love the Finger Lakes because you've stayed here. Are either of you or both of you worried about what's happening environmentally in this area? Fracking, overdevelopment? Can you talk a little bit about how you feel about your neighborhood?
Yeah, part of my book about Wyoming was it took place in central Wyoming, right in an area where they were doing a lot of natural gas exploration and drilling. And so I got to see kind of up close and personal what that whole operation looks like. And years ago, before anyone was thinking about the Marcellus Shale. So when this reared its ugly head, you know, I knew what lay ahead. And it does worry me. And you know, I try to put my money where my mouth is and work toward preserving what I see as some of the best part of where we live, which is water, watershed, and people and landscape.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about you, Amy?
Well, I feel like, as someone who owns, you know, a lot of property in the country, I'm more open to fracking maybe than other people would like. So I'm actually fascinated by the whole discussion, because I can see why farmers who are no longer able to make a living on their land see a way to pay their property taxes. So I really do see that side of it as well. It's mm-hmm. a fascinating, fascinating topic. And one of the things I love about living in the Ithaca area is how much people love, you know, we all love this place. And so people are so passionate. And I really like that. I used to tell, quick story. I used to call my mom on Sundays when I lived in Chicago. And I'd just chat with her on Sundays, and I'd usually read to her some of the letters I was getting. And once my column started appearing in the Ithaca Journal, I started getting the best letters from Ithaca. Always, like, super, super smart, but very kind of snippy, too. Like, "Dear Amy, I don't know if you're aware of recent research showing blah, blah, blah." You know, so smart, but so mouthy. And we would laugh. I would read these letters to her, and we would laugh and laugh and laugh. There is no place like this place.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are worried about, that it will be forever ruined by some of this if it's not thought out correctly and done right.
But that's, I mean, fortunately, we do live in a place where people do feel free to make their opinion known and mm-hmm. and loudly. Mm-hmm. You know, they are not shy about putting it out there. And as you can see, even in families, that there are going to be differences of opinion.
I see that.
And it'll make for some interesting Thanksgiving talk this year, perhaps.
I may get smacked.
Yeah. I know. Look out. Yeah.
Well, you know, since your book, The Mighty Queens of Freeville, has come out, all kinds of people are visiting the little village and probably looking for your houses. Did you ever feel unsafe or like you've been intruded upon? Or has this been a good thing for these small towns?
I love it so much, I can't even tell you. When I heard that a book group from Mexico, New York. Do you know where Mexico is?
No.
It's up past Watertown.
Like,
there's nothing past Watertown except a place called Mexico. And by the way, why do you name a town Mexico that's like up near Canada? But anyway, this book group, these like 9 women drove for hours to come see Freeville and look around Dryden. And I love that so much. They got the biggest kick out of it. And they ended up going to the diner where we have breakfast, and they met my mom and my aunts. It was like this whole thing. It was really fun. It was, and okay, so this Porsche pulls up in front of my house on Main Street, and a man is kind of, he's got a map, he's looking around. So naturally, I assume he's looking for me in my house, and I think, I'm going to give him the thrill of his lifetime. So I walk out, and I say, "Hey there, hi, can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah, there's a dentist down here." I was so disappointed.
This is a question for Rachel. Do you choose your assignments, subjects, or are you asked to write about specific subjects? Do you get to choose what you write about?
It works both ways. I'm a freelance writer, so what I like to do is figure out what stories I want to write about. So I do a lot of research, and I'm constantly pitching editors at magazines. I decide the publication I want to write for. I study the magazine. Then I pitch them my ideas. 99% of them get shot down, and that's oh so much fun and really is helps your ego. But I've been doing it for about 10 years, so you get a pretty thick skin, and you build up kind of a list of clients, of people, editors who you want to work with and who want to work with you. And sometimes it's a blessing when an editor comes to you and says, "Hey, do you want to write about XYZ?" And sometimes it's a curse. So because they could give you a crappy assignment, but you don't want to turn it down, so you got to do it anyway. So I always try to control the content.
It's
such a fascinating way to make a living when you think about it. There's endless variety. I was a freelancer for quite a while. There's just a tremendous amount of variety, and if you can stand the weird downtime and the anxiety of where your next job is going to come from and all the pitches that don't work out, but it's an amazing, amazing way to make a living, I think.
I have to ask you about this, Amy. You began your book tour with a guest spot on The View, and Barbara Walters made it very clear.
I thought we were on The View now.
Barbara Walters made it very clear that she does not like you.
Really, Tish?
Yeah,
how,
yeah.
Who have you been talking to?
But to tell us about that. She's upset because Ann Landers is dead or something, right?
Yes, I wow. Go right there, Tish. Go right to the source of the pain. So yeah, I went on The View, and I just want to say at the outset, I felt like it went fantastic. I thought it was awesome and great.
Then she called her mother.
I happened to be watching it with her.
I called my mom, and she said, oh, dear, 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 dear. And so then I was prompted to watch the segment on tape, and I then could see that it had, in fact, gone very, very badly.
You could see the eye
because
rolling.
It was all in the body language. They're very smart on The View. They sit you on a couch, so you're next to someone. You can't see what they're doing. You can't see how they're emoting to the camera when you're turned the other way, which I will never do again. Don't ever turn your back on Barbara Walters. That's all I can say. If, say, you'd like to talk to Whoopi Goldberg, who's sitting on your left, I suggest you wait until after the show, because while I was turned, you know, exchanging, you know, and participating with someone else on the show, Barbara Walters was like rolling her eyes. She had this horrible body language. But you know what my mom said yesterday? She sort of smacked Rob Morrow when he tried to kiss her, like in greeting, like, hello, Barbara. And she was like, get away from me. So she's very testy.
It's because she can't close her eyes now or for now. So she's kind of frozen in time.
It was just such an experience because I'm on the show. It's obviously very, very high profile, but I am so spoiled by NPR, frankly, because I thought, crazy cuckoo me, I thought that if I went on the show, they would actually know who I am and maybe have read, if not the book, then at least
a
press release about the book. No one had read anything. They were completely unprepared in any way that I could anticipate. And they just kept lobbing me these very challenging advice-type questions. It was actually, I will say this, it was so much easier dealing with Bill O'Reilly than...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you knew what you were going
to
get.
Well, he needs a lot of advice.
I told him that. He had this whole thing about spanking. He kept thinking he was challenging me on spanking children as if that's controversial. Like, I'm going to advocate for spanking. I said, does anyone think spanking is a good idea? Well, Bill O'Reilly does think it's a good idea. He thinks spanking is a very good idea. And at the end of this very challenging segment, I said to him, well, I think you need to be spanked, mister. Later on, I learned that he sort of likes that.
You could have had a date.
I know.
Well, Rachel, you recently wrote an article about green burial that caused a little bit of controversy. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's an important subject as well that needs to be talked about.
I actually love the topic. I've been following it for about a decade, and there is a green burial place in Newfield, Green Springs, that I love. I just think it's an amazing place. I've been there a couple of times. And I happened to see a funeral there. I went up for a funeral. And then I wrote about it for Salon.com. And they trimmed a lot of the piece. It was too long. They trimmed stuff out, which was fine. I still thought it read fine. Well, it got a lot of comments. And it was, I think last time I looked, 528 people liked it, which I thought was awesome. But then there were those 67 nasty comments that I had to deal with. It did, you know, some people loved it. There were some local people involved with Green Springs who did not like what I did at all. And it caused quite an upheaval in that community. And I felt terrible about that. But after a while, I just felt like, you know, I was writing about something that I think is important, and I'm sorry they didn't like the approach I took, but it is the approach I took. That's
so
that.
Did you, were you required to like read all the posts, or do you just want to read all of those?
I wanted to sit with a bottle of wine and read those posts and then stick needles in my eyes after. It was a terrible experience because you read the first couple, you think, oh, this is going well. Oh, yeah, oh, people really like this. And, oh, they talk about the fascinating topic, blah, blah. And then you get to the nasty ones. And I responded to a couple, and then my husband my husband said, what are you doing? Can, you know, just, you know, take the keyboard away. You can read the post, but do not respond. You're just baiting them. So, you know.
They love it when you respond.
Do.
It's like you're pouring kerosene on their own ambitions, really.
Yeah, see, I was going to ask you, how do you deal with conflict like that? I mean, you obviously get people disagreeing with you. How do you deal with that kind of negativity?
The amount of space that takes up in your day, people email. I never read the posts, you know, that run along with my column when it runs online. I just don't. And then I asked the web people if they thought I should, and they said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. It's a vortex you cannot get out of. I get a lot of email and mail disagreeing with me, and I actually mainly I go through these jags where I start demanding apologies. I mean, what am I?
You mean
thinking?
In print, or you do it privately?
No, I'll email them back like, I demand an apology. It's so crazy. I just, and every time people say like, whoa, you read this? You know? Like, whoa. So mainly I completely shock people when I respond to something negative they've said. And honestly, when people are very, very mean-spirited, I always respond and I say, look, we run a clean bar here. So you have something to say. If you can say it respectfully, I'll consider running it in my column. And they're always so grateful that I've gotten back to them. And didn't think anybody read it.
So. And I should have known better. I was president of a school board. Now, talk about the worst job in the world, volunteer job, and you just let yourself open for every comment. Anyone who wants to say anything feels like they can, not only in the meeting, but in the supermarket, on the street, leaving notes on your door, pinned to your door, you know, put it under your dog's collar. I mean, it's awful. So, you know, you get a thick skin when you deal with stuff like that, and I just had a momentary lapse. That's all. It'll never happen again. No.
Here's another question for Rachel. When you were young, did you have indications of where you each would end up? Did you have predictions about your futures?
When I was young, I wanted to be a lawyer and a politician. Okay, my political aspirations led me to being a trustee in the village of Freeville. I frankly thought I was going to go a little further than that. I was thinking at least the state legislature. No, come on. But because I loved Connie Cook. I don't know if anyone remembers how wonderful she was. And when I was in high school, I actually went to Albany with her. She took me to Albany with her so I could watch her do her.
She was in the state legislature, right?
She was. Yeah. She was this wonderful, amazing woman. And so I thought I had this mentor, and I was destined for greatness. I just didn't know that my greatness would only extend in a one-mile radius. So. And about everyone else, who knew? You know, you're so solipsistic when you're young. You don't know. You can't imagine your siblings even growing up. Like, they will always be eight.
Right. You had Amy planted on that table singing.
Exactly.
Demanding her to sing for the rest of her life. Oh, I want to talk to you about, you're writing a research article about feral cats now. Is that true? I mean.
Well, I was going to. I'm always casting about for a book topic, and that was one that I did a lot of research in, and I thought that I was going to follow an organization, a national organization in Washington that's set up to protect feral cats. And I actually found out after spending 3 days with them that it was,
I'm not a cat person.
I knew I was a cat person, but I actually was not. I wasn't as crazy as they were. I thought I was pretty crazy, but you know.
You weren't a cat person.
That's exactly right. It was like Uber cat person. I mean, they were Uber, and in fact, I was spending 3 days with this organization, and you know, they've got a huge staff and lawyers, and you know, people just dealing with legal issues all around the country having to do with cats, and particularly cats and birds and the problems therein. So I felt torn about that. But while I was sitting there, I'm dressed all in black. We're at this meeting table. Well, they have cats all over the office. And, you know, like a big white one would come and just flop down in front of me and, you know, and just spread out. And they and clean himself. And I'm sitting there with my tape recorder and my notepad and trying to ask questions over the cat. And it was just a different way of doing business. So I did not pursue the feral cats.
Decided not to do the feral cats.
Yeah,
I can understand that.
I have the story in my head.
Amy, are you amazed that so many people still ask for advice from strangers? I mean, I still find it very odd.
Yes.
Is it a certain type of person? I mean, you've been doing this for 7 years. Did you have a take on who it is? Are they really lonely people? Or
tends to be people with problems, Tish. You know, and I catch myself going like, what's with all the problems? And then I think, well, they're the ones who are providing the material, as we say. I don't think of them as lonely, no. It's funny. I feel like this advice column genre is really old. It's so old, it's like we've absorbed it. I was shocked. Okay, the first day I write the column, we're thinking, what if you throw a column and nobody comes? You know, like, how do we get people to write in? And so we had it all fixed up that some of our more messed up colleagues would provide, you know, some letters for the first. Well, it goes to show you, they ran an ad about a week before they started running ads in the paper, and the mail poured in. But here's what gets me. The letters, it's like they're perfect. People always ask me if I rewrite the letters. I never rewrite the letters. They come in, they're three paragraphs. They get right to it. And what I love is that people, like, they get what advice columns are for. I almost never get a letter that's completely inappropriate for a column. People know what these columns do. And I, you know, it's just this incredibly vibrant.
Yeah, it really is a part of our culture now.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's almost a habit.
Can you figure out which ones are fake?
You know,
my
editors asked me before I started writing the column, they said, we got to ferret out those fakes. And they were overly concerned about it. In fact, one editor suggested, this was great. She's so responsible. She said, I feel like we really need to verify the identity of all the people who write to you. I said, oh, really? So I'm going to respond and say, like, dear Busted in Boston, are you in fact Busted in Boston? And is your husband / wife still giving you a hard time? Like, you can't, like, get back to people.
Verify this.
Yeah. So once we worked out that little problem, and that people are just guaranteed anonymity and they write with you assuming that they will be. But I said to them right off the bat, I said, look, I think I can sniff out a fake letter because I think like the kind of jerk that writes a fake letter. It's like, and I think they have certain elements in common. They're usually sort of funny, kind of plausible, and they often involve some sort of bodily function.
Ah.
And I have to say, I know a couple have snuck through, but I found a fake letter that I knew was fake because it was based on an episode of The Simpsons. Yeah. My husband, Homer, you know, it wasn't like rocket science,
Bart.
But I decided, you know, not to run this particular letter, and Dear Abby ran it.
Really?
The person had written to Dear Abby, and Dear Abby ran that letter. Ha ha.
Well,
so, you know what? 25 years of watching The Simpsons. Ka-ching. Yeah.
Well, we are almost out of time, and I have to. I want to end it with something that you said in your book that I find really apropos. You said, we have lived small lives of great consequence, and I think you were talking about all of us. Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tish.
And thank you all for coming. This has been great.
Hey. Yeah, happy anniversary, yeah. Tish.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. We hope to have many more. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.